I next met with Dr. Bradley Monk, and to begin, he discussed the management of initial recurrence in patients with ovarian cancer.
So if the patient recurs within the first 6 months, that's a platinum-resistant recurrence, and we'll talk about that in a minute. But greater than 6 months is platinum-sensitive relapse. And when I say platinum-sensitive, I generally only mean second and third line. By the time you get to fourth and fifth line, things are very different. But this is second line, and it's, let's say that, you know, typical would be 10 to 12 months. She would have platinum-sensitive relapse, and again, I generally only begin treatment when there's measurable disease I can see. And why do I treat? Because I don't want her to get a malignant bowel obstruction or ascites. And it's a platinum doublet. And there are three commonly used platinum doublets. Retreatment with carboplatin paclitaxel, okay? Carboplatin gemcitabine, that's on label since 2006. Gemcitabine 1,000, day one, day eight. The carboplatin is reduced a little bit because these patients have been pre-treated. When you use carbo with gem, it's only an AUC of 4. And then carboplatin pegylated liposomal doxorubicin. And so it's clear, again, a carboplatin doublet, but the trick is to pick the second agent, paclitaxel, gemcitabine, or pegylated liposomal doxorubicin. And how you decide that is a personalized approach, convenience. The carbo PLD is every 4 weeks. Neuropathy, if neuropathy is a problem, you don't want to use paclitaxel, that sort of thing.
Looking back, though, in terms of this woman's presentation and her going to surgery, assuming she has a good response, you're able to do an R0 resection. What's the chance of a patient like that being cured?
Right. So a patient like this one, stage 4 neoadjuvant, the chance is almost zero. There'll be a few, but it's pretty low, maybe less than 5%. But in those patients where you're lucky enough, as you said, in the beginning to do an operation, and you can have an R0, as many as 20 to 30% of those patients can be cured. Yes, we can cure 20 to 30% of advanced ovarian cancer patients. And there was a recent paper this month, actually, and it was written up in many of the media, that in California, they reported on that. And they said, wow, patients are living a lot longer, and that's true. And it's not one specific intervention. It's good surgery. It's good chemotherapy. It's good supportive care, okay? So the preference, obviously, is frontline surgery if you can get away with it and have an R0.
So I want to get more into treating a patient like this as disease progresses, but just also pick up on another point that you brought up before in terms of intraperitoneal therapy. There have been a lot of publications. There was one recently, had a lot of media coverage about the fact that it's, you know, intraperitoneal therapy is not by any means universally done in clinical practice. And as far as I know, in your clinical practice, it's not done very much. What's your take on this? You know, sometimes you read some of these pieces and it comes across as, well, why aren't we giving, you know, standard therapy and not really getting into the controversy about whether or not this really is indicated?
Right. So as I kind of alluded to, but not in detail in our little case, intraperitoneal chemotherapy has three nuances. Yes, where you put the chemotherapy, but it's also weekly and dose intense. And to sort out or disassemble the intraperitoneal piece is naive. And remember, in our case, we treated her with weekly and dose intense. We just didn't do the intraperitoneal. So how critical the intraperitoneal component is, because those patients get dose intense and weekly, is unknown. So I like this idea of intraperitoneal chemotherapy, which is weekly and dose intense. I just don't know what the contribution of administrating the chemotherapy in the belly. But we know from other trials that weekly and dose intense is important. So that's the controversy, and intraperitoneal is more toxic. So these people that say it's absolutely the way to go, we don't really know that. And you know, last time we spoke in the Journal of Clinical Oncology, there was a paper, lead article, editorial, that in those intraperitoneal studies, that there was a 10-year survival advantage, okay? Why? Because they had intraperitoneal, dose intense, and weekly. And whether it was just intraperitoneal or not, I'm not sure.
What kinds of complications concern you the most in terms of IP therapy?
So again, you can hear in my voice that I'm really focused on survivorship. Pain. It hurts to fill your belly full of chemotherapy. And is associated with that intestinal irritation, there's nausea, okay? And as you do more dose intensity, there's the chemotherapy-related side effects, whether it be neuropathy or marrow suppression.
So going back to our typical situation, the patient gets second-line treatment. What's a typical next decision that comes up?
Well, let's finish up on that because we talked about the platinum doublets, but you didn't ask me, as you usually do, should this patient get bevacizumab? See, we have a bevacizumab-naive patient, and bevacizumab is FDA-approved, and we want our patients to get it generally because it's effective and generally well-tolerated. But this would be an off-label indication, see? So platinum-sensitive relapse is off-label. We have a paper that's been presented but not published that in this platinum-sensitive relapse scenario that when bevacizumab is added to carboplatin paclitaxel retreatment, that there's a 5-month survival advantage. So again, off-label, that 5-month survival advantage missed statistical significance. It was 0.056 was the p-value, but 5 months is 5 months. So many of us are using bevacizumab, no matter what chemotherapy backbone you use, and many of us are retreating with carboplatin paclitaxel if neuropathy and alopecia is not a problem. So my go-to regimen in that setting for this patient, if I could get it reimbursed, understanding that it's off-label, would be carboplatin paclitaxel bevacizumab based on GOG-213. And we need to get that into the literature so your listeners can understand it. And my sense is that that's going to be a label expansion, that the existing label in platinum-resistant disease ultimately will be expanded to platinum-sensitive disease, although that's going to depend on some regulatory decisions.
Can you review the design of 213 and what it showed?
Yeah, 213, simple. Just like this patient, platinum-sensitive relapse, randomized in an open-label fashion, carboplatin paclitaxel again, carboplatin paclitaxel Bev, and there was an improvement in progression-free survival and 5-month overall survival, about 37 to 42 months. 5 months OS, that's pretty good in our disease, but again, it's not gotten the attention that it deserves because it missed statistical significance, 0.056. But we'll see what the regulators say. They may say, look, that's close enough, and so we're eager to see what that does. You know, regulatory approval in ovarian cancer is important to us because it drives reimbursement. You know, the clinical trials are there, but we're moving more and more towards on-label use.
What is your experience in terms of trying to access bevacizumab in the platinum-sensitive situation? Are you usually able to get it paid for?
Yeah, so it's highly dependent on the region. As I mentioned in the beginning, I'm here in Phoenix, Arizona. We generally have no trouble. With it being FDA approved, the payers generally aren't savvy enough to say, oh, this is platinum sensitive rather than platinum relapse. Occasionally they are, but we generally don't have a problem. But I know in other parts of the country they do.
What's your experience with bevacizumab combined with chemotherapy and ovarian cancer in terms of tolerability issues?
Right. So the most common serious adverse event is hypertension. I actually have all my patients who start on an anti-VEGF therapy monitor their blood pressures at home. Remember, I come out of OBGYN. We in the department have pregnant patients. Pregnant patients monitor their blood pressures at home for preeclampsia. So we have this whole system, and we started this years ago. And then we're pretty aggressive in treating these patients with hypertension, and I treat them myself. I don't send them to the internist. The last thing I want is for them to get malignant hypertension, posterior reversible encephalopathy syndrome, have a seizure. How you treat hypertension, generally it's an ACE inhibitor or a calcium channel blocker. I'm kind of an ACE inhibitor guy, lisinopril, 10 a day starting. But the real serious one is not the hypertension because we can control it. It's not the proteinuria, it's not the wound healing. It's not even the bleeding, which are generally just nosebleeds. It's the GI perforation. And GI perforation is related to the number of lines of therapy. So that's why bevacizumab is only limited to second and third line. Because when you get to fourth and fifth and sixth line, those patients are at higher risk of GI perforation. In one study, it was 11%. And also patients who have inflammatory bowel disease, okay, are not good candidates for bevacizumab. And then if you're using it up front, patients who have had a lot of intestinal surgery and anastomosis are not good candidates. So my experience has been good, but this is still a dangerous medication. It still causes serious adverse events. And some patients, you can't get their hypertension controlled, and the discontinuation rate, you know, can be as high as 15 to 20% if not managed aggressively.
So continuing on in this case, what would be the next likely decision you would need to make?
Right. So bevacizumab is given with chemotherapy and then in maintenance. So generally, she would have another good response. And generally, she would go in bevacizumab maintenance. But what happens, the second relapse is not going to last as long as the first. So remember, her first relapse was in the 10 to 12 month range. The next relapse is going to happen, you know, half of that, which is going to be 5 to 6 months. And so now this third line treatment that she's going to have is going to be platinum resistant disease. And this is a very typical scenario. 6 cycles again of carboplatin paclitaxel bev, transition her to bevacizumab maintenance, hoping that she doesn't recur, but we know that she will.
And at the point that she does develop a recurrence, what are the thoughts that you have in that situation?
Yeah, so the three most, I told you there's 3 platinum sensitive approaches, carbogem, carboPLD, and carbopaclitaxel. Now there's 3 options again. Weekly paclitaxel, generally 80 milligrams, 3 out of 4 weeks, although you can just keep doing it without a break. PLD, generally at 40 milligrams per square meter, that's pegylated liposomal doxorubicin, 40 every 4 weeks. The label is 50, we all give 40. And then topotecan is also labeled. It's inconvenient because it's daily times 5. The label is 1.5 milligrams per square meter. That's probably too much here. Most of us would give maybe 1.25. We used to give a lot of weekly topotecan. It's probably less active. So 3 chemotherapy regimens, weekly paclitaxel, PLD, or topotecan, daily times 5. Now, on label here, though, you can have those same chemotherapies, those 3 of them, and add bevacizumab. But if you used it in platinum-sensitive relapse, this would now not be on label, although some people might try to keep the bevacizumab going post-progression and just start chemotherapy up again. I do that a lot. Again, it's off-label. The evidence is lacking. Maybe it's not the right thing to do. I'm not sure.
Of course, that's a common strategy in colorectal cancer where they actually have randomized data addressing that question. Looking back at the whole scenario that you just described, how would it change if you knew the patient had a BRCA germline mutation?
Boy, good question. And again, NCCN, ASCO, and our society, the Society of Gynecologic Oncologists, all 3 recommend that every patient, everyone, with an epithelial ovarian cancer be BRCA tested. And in the beginning, as I said, the chance is about 15 to 20%. As the patients respond over and over again, the chance of being BRCA positive increases because the BRCA positive patients do better. The phenotype of BRCA germline mutation is multiple responses and frequently high-grade serous, but not always. You can't figure out who's BRCA positive based on histology, age of onset, or family history. That's why we test everyone. So to this point, it probably would not have changed much, but now if she's going to fail platinum-resistant treatment, that will be her 3rd treatment. And then what's next would be 4th line, and she could be treated on label with olaparib. We've had olaparib, the first in-class PARP inhibitor, FDA approved since December 19th, 2014, approved for 4th line and beyond in patients with a BRCA deleterious or suspected deleterious germline mutation.
I want to ask you to go through some of the clinical research data addressing that question as well as other PARP inhibitors. But just to get back to BRCA testing, can you comment a little bit about the various types of assays that are done right now and how you utilize these?
So first of all, you know, who should test these patients? And I'll get back to that. But we do a lot of testing in my office. And when I test in my office, I only test for BRCA. I can counsel the patients, but there are these panels that are BRCA-like genes that are part of the HBOC, hereditary breast and ovarian cancer syndrome. It takes a lot of counseling, and I don't have the expertise or time to do that. But I have no trouble in my office just testing for BRCA. The Myriad test is the one that's the companion diagnostic for olaparib. I've never had a denial for olaparib if another non-Myriad company has done the test. So you can test anyone. So the first question is, who should order the test, me or the genetic counselor? The second is, should it be BRCA alone or should it be a panel? I generally test in my office because insurance doesn't pay for counseling. Counseling is really important, but if I want her tested according to the guidelines, send her to a counselor and the insurance denies it, then the only thing that happened is she didn't get tested. So I don't, when I test out of my office, I don't mean to usurp the great work and important work of a counselor. I'm just trying to be practical because genetic counseling isn't paid for very well.
Can you talk a little bit more about the types of panels that are done and what you do if someone has, you know, some type of variant mutation?
Right. So the panels generally test for other hereditary genes, such as P53 Li-Fraumeni, such as the mismatch repair genes, which we see in the Lynch syndrome. And we have guidelines on how to deal with those. But your question was a variant of undetermined significance. A variant of undetermined significance is handled as negative. So we try not to get distracted. What the provider will say, well, Brad, the mother had a VUS. I'm like, of course, how else did she inherit it? Right? So just because the mother had ovarian cancer and the daughter has a VUS doesn't mean that the variant of undetermined significance is etiologic. We inherit these genes from our parents. So the fact that it's carried on across the lineages doesn't mean it's etiologic. And most of the time, they're not attributable to the cancer. Good question.
So maybe you can comment a little bit about the available clinical research data on olaparib in ovarian cancer, and then we'll talk about other PARP inhibitors.
Sure. So back to our case, it's actually been a very nice progression, no pun intended, that she now has fourth line treatment. And in fourth line, platinum sensitive and platinum resistant is no longer that important, partly because some patients are just all going to be resistant like this patient. But many patients who get a better start, remember our patient didn't get a good start because she was stage four and had to have neoadjuvant. But in the patient that had a better start because she could have a frontline operation, generally would have responded to platinum many times. And she's starting to get burned out on her platinum. And although she may be platinum sensitive, fourth line platinum may not be the right treatment for her. So this idea of platinum resistant and platinum sensitive really only applies to second and third line treatment. So what happened here, fourth line, the FDA granted accelerated approval for olaparib based on a 137 patient single arm trial. And they showed that in those patients who had measurable disease that were BRCA mutation carriers, that the response rate was 34%, pretty high for fourth line. And not only was the response rate high, but the duration of response, 7.9 months, was also high. So based on this, in the FDA's judgment, high response rate and durable response is 7.9 months, the FDA granted accelerated approval also based on the toxicity profile, which is very important because all of our medications are toxic. And the major toxicities here were fatigue, bone marrow suppression, and GI, dyspepsia, nausea, and diarrhea. So that's what happened. 137 phase two, patient phase two, 34% response rate, 7.9 month median response duration. But that's not enough. As you know, accelerated approval simply means that you got the ball rolling. And so there are lots of other trials, as you mentioned, that are ongoing to try to confirm or refute that, and lots of other PARP inhibitors in development.
Can you talk about what's known about olaparib as maintenance therapy?
Yeah, so we said that patients with BRCA mutations respond to platinum over and over again, and maybe we should use PARP inhibitor maintenance in those patients that respond. And in fact, that's the European label. Our label is fourth line and beyond. The European label is platinum-sensitive maintenance. Now, you can use platinum-sensitive maintenance in our country so long as it's fourth line, okay? So you can't use it second or third line. And that's not a subtle distinction. But platinum-sensitive maintenance, a good strategy. You can improve the PFS from about 4 months to about 11 months. In fact, that's what I told you in our case. I said she's going to recur in 4 to 5 months. These are pretty standard metrics. But in a BRCA patient, If you add a Laprib, you can extend that 4 months to 11 months. And I haven't said it, but a Laprib is an oral medication. And it's 400 milligrams BID. The tolerability is maybe a little better than chemotherapy, although that's one of the confirmatory trials as part of the due diligence for accelerated approval is to compare it to IV chemotherapy. But it's certainly more convenient, we can say that.
Can you talk about, for practical purposes, exactly what you do when you start a patient on a Laprib? How do you counsel them? What do you tell them to expect? What kinds of medications you give to them?
Right. So as you know, we're going to central pharmacies. It creates a bureaucracy at some level, but also improves our efficiency. To get a Laprib, you fill out a piece of paper, you fax it in. They deal with the insurance and everything. And then what you said, they mail the medication to the patient. So the first thing I do is I say, look, when you get this in the mail, don't start it. Come to me and let's have a on your marks, get set, go sort of encounter. And so they'll come in. They say, look, here is what I have. They have some pill boxes. I tell them that they're going to take 8 capsules. The capsules are only 50 milligrams, so 400 milligrams twice a day. I tell them not to crush or break the capsules. I tell them if they skip one, not to make it up. I tell them that they can take it with meals. I tell them that they can even take 1 capsule at a time. So 1 capsule drink, 1 capsule drink. They don't need to take 8 capsules, fill their mouth up, and hope they can swallow it. And then I counsel them regarding the side effects and fatigue, certainly, and that's with all our medications. I tell them that we're going to monitor their blood counts every month because anemia specifically can occur. But I spend a lot of time about GI toxicities. We talked about bevacizumab, how the Achilles heel with bevacizumab is GI perforation. The Achilles heel with the Laprib is intestinal toxicity. So I say, look, you're probably going to do okay here, but you might have some nausea. And if you have some nausea, here's a prescription for ondansetron, fill it, carry it in your purse. I said, you also could get some diarrhea. Go get some Lomotil, carry it. And I said, you also can get some acid in your stomach, so go ahead and take some Protonix. Take it now. And I say, if you get the diarrhea or the nausea, take those medications. And if it doesn't help, stop it and call me. Patients think that they need to gut it out, that they're supposed to be sick. I try to empower my patients that chemotherapy-related side effects are really not tolerable. You're not supposed to have them. And so then if they get this nausea, this diarrhea, we ask them to hold it. And unlike many medications where a break requires a dose reduction, these patients frequently will acclimate. And on the label, it says that the median time to dose interruption was only 6 days, which is a week. And so I have them hold it for a week and start it again, frequently without a dose reduction because the body will acclimate to it.
And what fraction of patients using that kind of approach are able to take the drug with, you know, without major problems?
So the dose interruptions are relatively high, 30 to 40%, but the dose reductions, as I mentioned, are low, closer to 10%, okay? So just because you have a dose interruption to let the patient acclimate doesn't mean that you need to do a dose reduction, but dose reductions are generally done for fatigue, for GI disturbances, which I just mentioned. We generally don't dose reduce for anemia. We generally transfuse the patient and keep on marching along.
I was going to ask you about anemia. When do you typically see it and how do you manage it?
So it's a cumulative toxicity. The GI toxicity can happen relatively early on, but it's cumulative. I manage it with transfusions. It would be certainly acceptable to use erythropoietin stimulating agents through their risk evaluation mitigation strategy, the REMS. It's not what we do. We use blood transfusion because it's cheap, it works, and it's safe. And the patients are coming and are familiar with our infusion center. And we do it when they're symptomatic. And every patient is symptomatic at a different time. And again, it's about survivorship. So we actually try to anticipate. So we'll have a threshold, and our nurses know that this patient is pretty durable. She becomes symptomatic at a hemoglobin of 7 or 8. So when she gets like 8-ish, before she gets to 7 and symptomatic, we'll transfuse her. Rather than have her get symptomatic and recover, because that's not accomplishing our goal of survivorship and good quality of life. Some patients get symptomatic between 8 and 9. Very few patients are symptomatic, though, above 10.
What do we know about second cancers and leukemia with olaparib?
Yeah, right? So I didn't explain how this works, but maybe now's a good time. PARP inhibitors prevent the repair of single-stranded DNA damage. PARP is an enzyme. When we have DNA damage, we get single-stranded breaks. PARP, poly-ADP ribose polymerase, repairs those single-stranded breaks. If you inhibit that enzyme, the single-stranded break becomes a double-stranded break, and double-stranded breaks are repaired through homologous recombination, which is what BRCA does. So that's the link. Single-stranded break, you can't repair it because of a PARP inhibitor. Get a double-stranded break, can't repair it because of a BRCA mutation, the cell dies, okay? So what is known about second cancers? Well, when you start inhibiting DNA repair, you can promote mutations, which is just what we said, and second cancers, specifically myelodysplastic syndrome and acute myelogenous leukemias, have been reported. Now, the difficulty is it because of the PARP inhibitor, or is it because of the other DNA damaging agents, platinum? I don't know. Let me tell you how often it happened, though. In the labeled study, it was 2%. Across the database for olaparib, which is 2,500 patients, it's 1.4%. So you get it, it's 1% to 2%. But I don't really know whether it's because of the platinums or whether it's become the PARP inhibitors, but this is an area of concern, and we are monitoring all of our patients, not only with PARP inhibitors, but with DNA damaging agents. So if you see a patient whose bone marrow doesn't recover, get a bone marrow biopsy. You might be surprised what you find.
What do we know about the responsiveness of patients with ovarian cancer, serous ovarian cancer, without BRCA mutations to PARP inhibitors and olaparib?
Yeah, so they can still respond, right? And that's why you asked me that. And why do they respond if they don't have a BRCA germline mutation? Because they have other genes that are in that pathway, the Fanconi anemia pathway, which are important in repairing those double-stranded breaks, those homologous recombination repair genes. So there are non-BRCA patients that can respond. And who are they? They're patients who respond to platinum many times, because if you can respond to platinum, you probably can't repair the DNA damage that platinum caused, and you probably have a BRCA-like abnormality.
So let's talk a little bit about new agents in ovarian cancer, beginning, and you alluded to this before, and you're right, almost every interview I do, regardless of tumor type, we're getting into the possibility of checkpoint inhibitors, anti-PD-1 agents in particular. We really saw some interesting data just at the ASCO meeting on that. Where are we today in terms of anti-PD-1 checkpoint inhibitors, anti-PD-1 antibodies in ovarian cancer and gynecologic cancer in general?
Yeah, so at ASCO, there were three phase two studies of three PD-1 or PD-L1 molecules. They had response rates about what you see in lung, 15%, 15 to 20%. Now, in ovarian cancer, we say, oh, that's not very high. But in lung cancer, it translated to a survival advantage. Ovarian cancer has tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes. Ovarian cancer expresses PD-L1. Ovarian cancer should be an ideal opportunity. So with those responses, there are a number of randomized trials that are launching. We have one within Energy Oncology, which is nivolumab versus nivo plus ipilimumab. So as you know, the company that makes nivo also makes ipilimumab. So it's nivo versus nivo ipi. So that's what the cooperative group is doing. But the other makers, for example, the company that makes avelumab, is very aggressive now in developing and designing phase three studies. They have the largest experience of anti-PD-L1. Their phase two that was presented at ASCO had 75 patients in it. And, you know, I told you about a 15% response rate. So this is exciting, dual checkpoint inhibition. And maybe we need to do immunostimulatory molecules. So not only interfere with checkpoint inhibition, but also upregulate the inflammatory response. And those phase twos are also being done.
So in the other cancers, including lung, as you mentioned, one of the things that's been most remarkable is the duration of response and the fact that some of these patients have much longer responses than we're used to seeing with the other agents. What do we know right now? I know it's very early, though, in terms of ovarian cancer.
So we're seeing the same thing, but the experience is not nearly as great. But in the avelumab experience, there were two clear cell cancers, and both of them had a response. So that may be a single in clear cell cancers. And as you know, it was recently reported in renal cell carcinoma, exciting new data in checkpoint inhibitors. So in clear cell cancers, you know, look under the microscope the same as they do their kidney counterpart.
Any particular toxicity issues in general? Anti-PD-1 antibodies have been, PD-L1 antibodies have been very well tolerated. Obviously, there are autoimmune complications. Anything that might be different in a patient with ovarian cancer that you might want to consider?
No, not to our experience. But interestingly, and if you look at some of the other solid tumors, you're able to actually operate on patients during checkpoint inhibition. So for frontline treatment in neoadjuvant therapy, for example, we mentioned in our case, it was very difficult to add bevacizumab to frontline treatment where neoadjuvant chemotherapy and interval debulking. We're thinking about maybe checkpoint inhibitors is a better biologic frontline because we can do surgery under the umbrella of checkpoint inhibition.
So what about cervical cancer? You know, we know in head and neck cancer that HPV-related head and neck cancer seems to respond quite well to anti-PD-1 antibodies. What do we know about cervical cancer at this point?
So there was an ipilimumab trial presented at ASCO. There were some responses, but because response was the primary endpoint, it missed its primary objective. Within energy oncology, we have a Nevo study. It's ongoing. It's a very small study. But we have very, very little information about these. Probably the most exciting immuno-oncology approach in cervical cancer is a listeria-based vaccine. So you can take listeria and pack it full of antigens. And so then as the patient's mononuclear cells phagocytize this intravenous listeria that they're given, they can learn and be taught and reprogrammed to develop an immune response. So there have been phase 2 studies reported, phase 2s that are ongoing, and ultimately a phase 3 that will launch very soon, looking at listeria-based immunotherapy with E6, which is the oncogene in HPV immunotherapy. So that's one of the ones that we're most excited about.
That's really fascinating. Another new approach that I thought was really interesting, we've been talking for quite a while now, breast cancer, about antibody-drug conjugate TDM1, trastuzumab memtansine in HER2-positive disease. In lymphomas, we've been talking about brentuximab vedotin, another antibody-drug conjugate. And now I see there's an agent, IMGN853, mirvetuximab soravtansine, a folate receptor alpha-targeting antibody-drug conjugate. Can you talk about what that agent is and what we know about it clinically?
Right. So folate is overexpressed on epithelial ovarian cancers and endometrial cancers too, and it can be targeted selectively. And as you know, we've actually failed, right? So we failed with ventafolide, which is the vitamin in a drug where the vitamin would bind to the receptor as a stealth sort of approach that failed. We've also failed with an antibody against folate, farletuzumab. So now this is a third attempt to have an antibody like farletuzumab, but to have this taxane-like microtubule molecule. So in the phase 1 study, which you're alluding to, which was presented at ASCO, there were a lot of responses. It looked pretty good. Patients who are typical in phase 1 studies that have lots of pretreatment, and they were seeing tumor shrinkages that were durable. So as a result of that, Immunogen, which makes this molecule, is now launching a more traditional randomized phase 2 trial, which you should see very soon. The idea is to open that before the end of the year.
Now, have responses been seen with endometrial cancer?
So they have, and the endometrial program is not quite as far along. These molecules have some unique side effects, and we always need to talk about side effects. They have some eye toxicity. So we're dealing with that. We're learning about whether or not the eye toxicity is related to the peak concentration or an area under the curve. And so some of these things about the doses and the schedules have delayed the development, but I think that the investigators have this figured out.
Yeah, I saw that thing about ocular toxicity. What exactly happens?
It's a corneal keratitis. It's associated with blurred vision. It's reversible. It's treated with intraocular steroids. But anything that happens with the eye gets people nervous. So I think that they're working on it, but to be clear, it's not the level of eye toxicity is probably going to interfere with the ultimate development. But eye toxicity, you know, this whole eye MEK inhibitors, right? MEK inhibitors have a whole eye toxicity. It's a different sort of retinal problem. But eye toxicities have been identified as a unique toxicity during this drug development process.
Now, again, in breast cancer and lymphoma, one of the advantages of these types of compounds and recognizing it's a different antibody and different compound is you're delivering chemotherapy to the tumor cells, but you don't see systemic chemotherapy issues like alopecia. Is that also the case with this agent?
That is, but because it's a microtubule inhibitor, there is a little bit of neuropathy. So there is some off-target sort of toxicities, but not nearly to the degree that we would see with traditional cytotoxics.
And again, we've seen some of that neurotoxicity with these other agents. So that sounds exciting and encouraging. Just sort of keeping along the theme of new and exciting agents, we were talking about bevacizumab before related to ovarian cancer, and there were some data presented at ASCO looking at bevacizumab and endometrial cancer. What do we know about Bev and endometrial cancer?
Yeah, so endometrial cancer is a challenge. It's a challenge because these patients are generally older. They're on many, many medications, and those comorbidities in the age group make it difficult. Having said that, it appears that bevacizumab can prolong progression-free survival. In one study versus historical control, it improved overall survival, although that's probably not the best way to prove it. We use it in endometrial cancer. It's off-label. It's difficult to get it approved. It has hypertension. You know, hypertension in elderly patients is a bigger problem.